This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. You're listening to our Week in Review program. Each week, we look through the headlines of the previous week and bring you what is most important. This week, we're going to do something very different from our usual format. Everything we talk about on this program, we view through the lens of how current events are fulfilling the prophecies of the Bible. Well, the Bible has a lot of prophecies about what this world is going to be like in just a short amount of time after these events come to a head. Your Bible says that our violent, sick world is going to explode, and then Jesus Christ is going to return. And it goes even further than that. It describes what the world would be like after Christ returns. So today, we imagine that future. We imagine reviewing the news of the week 100 years into the future, 100 years into the millennial rule of Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. We have a lot to discuss. We're very excited to report on what's been happening in the world over this past week. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. We have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
So let's dive into the news of the future, the news of the world tomorrow. Our top story today comes from the great nation of Algeria. There on the Mediterranean seashore sits the idyllic city of Tanouji. This city is always humming with conversation and music and business. But this week, the place is packed. There are thousands of Algerians and their guests there to experience the newest milestone in this famous city's development. It's an urban development plan that has spanned generations. I was in Tanouji earlier this week on Monday, and the experience was electrifying. I'm standing here in the middle of Coast Road in Tanouji. Around me, families picnic on the beach, and in Century Park, teenagers play catch. Children dart from one family to the next. Beneath swaying marula trees, storytellers, musicians, and guides tell the story of Tanouji, even as they begin a new chapter.
This is a big day for Tanouji, for Algeria.
Year-round, Tanouji hosts tens of thousands of visitors, particularly family patriarchs and urban designers. They come here for intelligence, for inspiration on how to build a city. But the main reason to be here this week is the grand opening. The crowds are here to experience the world that was Tanouji's new museum of the pre-war world.
It's beautiful, breathtaking.
The museum is the focal point here at the waterfront portion of the park. Its complexly incised exterior and densely stacked stories hint at the 6,000 years of human experience represented inside. Its shape is like a massive igneous rock jutting out of the earth and twisting slightly, almost humanly, upward. Each of the museum's 6 floors represent 1,000 years of human history prior to Christ's return.
We have some awesome pieces here. Real treasures.
That's Edwige Bonobo, curator of The World That Was.
We have biblical relics. Like on our 2nd floor, we have actual wood from Noah's Ark located on Mount Ararat, along with the blueprints that he used, that he left aboard, which we found in the Ark. We also have a huge section of the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel, of course, was all the way back in the 2nd millennium. And we also have other antiquities from other civilizations, like maps of the conquest from the Assyrian Empire. We have an actual book in remarkable condition recording the names of the Israelites, the Israelite families that were taken in captivity.
Bonobo is insistent about accuracy. He says that accurate, real pieces of mankind's tragic past move people more than anything else.
Obviously, there are things we had to reconstruct because they were just totally destroyed in the last great war. So much of the history is just so terrible to even think about. It's hard to understand what it was like but all the more important for us to remember. Because this is what we did to ourselves. This is the legacy of the world that was the world under the influence of Satan the devil.
Between the 5th and 6th floors, visitors rest at a balcony mezzanine overlooking Century Park. Then their tour culminates with the spectacular 6th floor. The 6th millennium ended with a shrapnel-filled explosion of deceptive religion, false knowledge, and mass-scale murder. And without completely overwhelming visitors, the 6th floor vividly recalls that tragedy. Thus ends The World That Was, Tanuji's latest, most sobering, and perhaps its most meaningful attraction.
We are very excited to share this with everyone.
That's Milud Tanuji, patriarch of the Tanuji family. The Museum of the World That Was marks a major milestone in his home's growth.
My great-grandfather wanted to give this gift to the generations. He started collecting artifacts back then. My grandfather was the first master builder. He laid the foundation. So yes, we've been laboring on this for a long time as a family. Going back decades now, the city fathers have preserved this spot for the museum and the park.
Like father, like son, Milud Tanuji has some projects of his own.
Yes, the outdoor auditorium. We're planting the ebony and rosewood trees for that now. We planted the spruce, so that should develop the right resonance right where my great-grandson is four.
Tanuji is a man of vision. And thankfully for us, so have been his fathers.
My fathers and their neighbors built this, not me. They've given us something to bring us together, to increase our gratitude for this blessed world, this blessed city we live in. We live in a world ordered and established in righteousness. Thank God for that tonight.
There's just one more thing about the World That Was tour. The experience doesn't quite finish with the 6th floor. As I slowly ascended the ramp leading on from the last great war, I walked onto the rooftop and into the glorious Mediterranean sun. Below sparkled the Algerian sand. Children and their elders laughed together. Flowers and fronds swayed. Streams splashed their way toward the sea. And I realized the 7th floor, the one I had taken for granted, the millennium. For KPCG, I'm Joel Hilliker, Tanuji, Algeria. Back here in the studio now, that experience is still almost overwhelming to think back on.
Yeah, my father is one of the planners for our central district. We've studied some of Tanuji's work, but how amazing to visit, especially this week.
You know, apart from the museum, one of the most amazing experiences is that Central Plaza District. It's just this gorgeous garden area, this exquisitely planned outdoor arboretum. You really have to see the way they've arranged these trees, these big multicolored trees, beautiful mature trees. They started this project two generations ago. So there's probably, I'd say, a 25 or 30 acre area that's just foot traffic, and it's just a hub, a lively hub of socializing and family activity. You feel so at home. There's shops there, there's craftsmen, vendors, they're selling furniture and clothing, what have you. But you just look at all this and you realize someone cared about creating this and giving me something beautiful to look at. This garden path, a sculpture, a gentle hill that rises in just such a way. There's just so much care that has been put into this. And in Tanuji, it's the work of a lot of people over the course of several generations.
I've heard some wonderful things about the music.
Yeah, there are musicians that practice and perform there in the plaza for several hours of each day. And I'll tell you, the music of Tanuji is really something special. It's very tuneful, very uplifting, but it's really unlike anything I've ever heard anywhere else.
So you said you reached the 7th floor. I've heard there's a pretty awesome restaurant. Did you get a bite to eat?
I did, and it is even better than the reviews. The food is almost all grown on site. There's a 7-acre farm that's right next to the museum. It's been in operation there for over 35 years. But the Tanuji's have gone all out to put together this menu of their favorite family foods. I had the lamb shanks, probably the best I have ever had in my life.
If I could just chime in about the outdoor arboretum he was talking about there, this is a wonderful example of advanced planning. That was an area that was just pockmarked with craters from the Great Tribulation, and this family has come in there, leveled the whole area, and added over 24 feet in elevation with rich, composted organic topsoil right in the heart of the city. So they essentially decided right from the beginning that this arboretum would be the hub. Everything else coming off of this, and they just made this ground something that the trees and the plants would love. They designed this arboretum with around 70 species of trees, all different types, and planted them in these patterns that basically make it a year-round fireworks show of color.
Yeah, not to mention that it's just a haven for birds. I think there's like over 100 species of birds they've documented in that arboretum that made it their home at different times of the year. All of it is just the feeling that it evokes is really tremendous. It's a very uplifting experience. So, Rob, you and your dad, all the other urban planners out there, you need to go to Tanuji. So we're going to turn our attention now to Asia and to Jeremiah Jacques. Jeremiah, first, give us the overview of the news out of the great Asian continent this past week.
Sure, yeah. First up is the news out of Gomer Salem, the capital of Japan. This morning, the Japanese officials announced that they have completed the cleansing of their final nuclear waste site. The final treatment of organic compounds happened early this year, and this week the soil and water have tested out. So that means that Japan is now entirely free of radioactive waste. Before the last Great War, the Japanese relied on nuclear energy for some 30% of their power. But the technology was of a type that produced tons of radioactive waste. So cleaning it properly and naturally has taken generations, but the nation is now entirely free of radioactive waste. Next, we go just across the sea to China, where the new Magog ambassadors debuted a massive production of David, The Endless Throne Begins. Some 75,000 people crowded into the auditorium to watch the musical production. The scenes there of the city of Jerusalem, the scenes of the soldiers, so many people on that panoramic stage. And the cast included over 1,000 performers. Just a huge performance with characteristic Chinese quality. And King David himself, from the royal family, was in attendance, and he gave an address afterward. So this was just a very moving cultural experience there in New Magog, China.
That is awesome, Jeremiah. Who played Zadok, out of curiosity? I'm just kidding. Big news out of Japan and China there. So the big story out of Asia this week.
That would have to be the new Moscow repurposing plant. It became fully operational on Tuesday, and I was there to witness it. The Prince of Russia said today that New Moscow has brought its fifth AK-47 repurposing plant online. Before the last Great War, the Russian-made AK-47 was the most abundant firearm on Earth. One in five guns was a Kalashnikov. It was used by over 100 national armies, by guerrilla soldiers, and by gangsters and terrorists of all kinds. Factories in the Soviet Union, and later in Russia and other nations, made stupefying quantities of these weapons every year. But the factories today don't make AK-47s. Instead, they convert them into something else. Cartload after cartload, cases upon cases of these weapons are arriving here at the load-on dock at the New Moscow plant. Inside, machine guns. 50,000 of these killing weapons coming in here every day. Here at the beginning of the repurposing line, stacks and stacks of these guns arrive, many of them still loaded.
We're careful here. Yeah, it can be dangerous. We do it a lot, but it's still sobering when you touch one of these things.
That is Dmitry Grebenchikov. He's one of 2,500 men volunteering to staff the plant. Half of the men work the morning shift and half the afternoon, as the men from the other group go home to work their farms. Workers on this end of the line are a little more reserved, a little more sober as they remove bullets from magazines and chambers. The gunpowder ends up being shipped to St. Petersburg, where it undergoes a neutralization process and ultimately is used to heal damaged soils. But the casings, the lead, the barrel, the lower receiver, the magazine, the stock, these parts head to different destinations.
We strip off the stocks here at the plant, and they're great for some of our handles for our harvesters, for hand planters, plows, and even some of our trimmers. And then there's still a lot of steel and a little bit of plastic and light alloy in the guns, springs and small mechanisms. And actually, the R&D crew is working on uses for some of the other small mechanisms, so we can maybe keep those intact and slot them right into a mower or a dashboard somewhere.
But for the time being, the parts of the guns are separated, organized, and melted down inside geothermal furnaces. This factory is powered by 100% clean energy, solar, wind, and geothermal. They've got an amazing amount of heat being pumped up from deep inside the earth, and it's more than enough to melt these components down to a malleable temperature. The largest building in the plant is the manufacturing building, which is fed almost nonstop by the repurposing line. Here, metal is forged, hammered, and stamped into new shapes and assembled in new ways. Shovels, tree trimmers, fruit pickers, gleaners, chisel plows, ridge plows, and parts for powered machinery. I stand a stone's throw from a 10-cubit-high machine, but I can still feel the heat from it. It is the metal former. Inside, AK-47 barrels are being sliced, heated, unfolded, combined, and stretched into the form of a small moldboard plow. Mr. Marco Kandinsky operates this machine.
Yeah, the moldboard plow is kind of a wing shape, and it's small. It can cleanly cut through soil and turn it over, so whether you're pulling it with a horse or an ox, it will plow only the amount of soil you need to seed and then cover that ground back up as it goes. We're mainly sending these to Africa.
Fields in many African nations have lain fallow for many generations, but with the right tools for the job, African farmers are producing crops all across the Sahel. We come finally to the load-out building. This is where the newly made farming implements go into clever containers that serve multiple uses. Of course, they protect the equipment while in transit, but then the containers can themselves be used as pressure tanks, workbenches, or other equipment, depending on how they are reconfigured. Once packaged, the equipment is ready to be distributed. Olga Lavrov works at the distribution center. She helps her father, who oversees this part of the operation.
A lot of the farming gear goes to farms here in Moscow, and maybe 20% goes to other parts of Russia. But 30% goes to Africa, because that's where they need it the most. So we want to give it to them and help them get their agriculture up to where it needs to be so they can further develop their culture.
The people who receive these farming tools are deeply grateful toward Olga and toward everyone who works here at the AK repurposing plant. The plant receives torrents of thank you letters, which they display on some of their walls here in the reception area. I'm looking at one massive wall covered with these notes of gratitude. And up at the top, the motto of the factory is written in large letters. They will hammer their swords into plowshares. For KPCG, I'm Jeremiah Jacques at the AK Repurposing Plant, New Moscow.
So, Jeremiah, you got to witness Mica 4 in action on an industrial scale.
It was really inspiring to see.
So, you described this scene there in the distribution center, in the reception area, just practically festive environment. But then you also talked about the volunteers in the load-in docks where these cases of weapons come in, and they're just a lot more sober. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. It's hard for most of us to understand just what these weapons did in the world that was, what they were intended to do, and the sole reason for their manufacture. And all of that, of course, was to commit murder. Before the return of Jesus Christ, men wielding AK-47s killed about 250,000 people every year. And at the start of the Great Tribulation, one out of every five firearms on the planet was an AK-47. So there was one of these for every 60 people on Earth. And they just killed so many people. So there's a lot for these workers at the load-in dock to be sobered about.
Right, but then what a joy for them at the other end of the factory to see them transformed into beautiful tools, life-giving tools. Just a lot of meaning in that scripture in Micah 4 when you understand that. Well, thank you, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program. But unlike our usual program this week, we're imagining some of the headlines and events from around the world 100 years into the future after Jesus Christ returns to earth and establishes his government. We're basing these prognostications on the prophecies of the Bible, which are loaded with wonderful details about utopia on earth once Christ becomes King of Kings. We're going to turn now to the Middle East. Brent Nachtigall is our Middle East man. What is some of the news out of that region this past week?
Well, the Central Authority for Roadworks announced this week, they're based in Jerusalem, that the superhighway that's connecting Berlin to Cairo through Jerusalem has actually been, its finish date has been revised down to being completed in the next 5 years instead of 10 years. There was a pretty substantial development in technology for automatic stone laying, and that's actually decreased the time. So that'll be done in 5 years, which is great for all the sojourners that are going to come into Jerusalem for the feast in 5 years' time.
Fantastic. And the main story out of the region?
Well, our main story from the Middle East section today comes from the banks of the Salt Sea. I had a chance to visit down there earlier this week, and they were recording a record catch, but that's not why I was there. There was another pretty substantial milestone that was being experienced by one of the families there. I'm walking along the Western Bank Promenade in the Salt Sea fishing village of En Gedi. Large eucalyptus trees sway overhead in the cool western breeze. I'm on my way to meet Dayag Avner. He's a fourth-generation Salt Sea fisherman. Dayag and I breakfast in his fishing hut, one of the dozens near the promenade. The teak walls are covered in tidy rows of fishing tackle, hooks, knives, net-mending shuttles, heavy coils of line. Dayag is about 55, with deep creases at his eyes from peering over the water, and from smiling. This week, those creases have grown a little deeper.
I've been fishing at En Gedi my whole life, but it still amazes me.
Dayag points out to the sea about 40 cubits away. It's shining like silver, encircled by verdant green hills.
It's a beautiful thing. The sun coming over the water, the spray, the lapping sound at night. It's home to us.
The Avners are one of the original families to fish En Gedi, and for them, this week is a special one. Dayag's great-grandfather, Jonathan, lived through the last Great War. And it was on this day, 100 years ago, that a steel shell-shocked Jonathan cast a line and caught a fish in a sea that was coming back to life.
He just wrote in his journal, "Caught a fish this morning. Hope for this place. Hope for this future. Hope for my sons." So we always just note this day when it comes around, you know. Just a reminder.
That little perch Jonathan caught a few years after the return of Jesus Christ would now get lost in the abundant catch the Avners bring in every day. They net so many now that Dayag's youngest brother, Gilead, now spends most of his work salting and shipping them.
Gilead's a busy man. Everyone wants our fish. Fish swimming in water that flows down here from Jerusalem's only spring. They're from a resurrected sea.
When Jesus Christ returned to Jerusalem, the ancient Gihon Spring began surging dramatically in volume. A river of fresh, living water flowed eastward, and it came here, to what was previously known as the Dead Sea.
When my father was growing up, it was the Dead Sea. It was dead, uninhabitable, you wouldn't believe it. Tan rocks, tan hills, prickly shrubs, almost no people, and no fish.
Dayag shows me to the journal, and in it, a yellow image of a wasteland. What are these numbers in the corner?
Years since Christ's return. This one is 1 year after. This is 2 years after.
As you flip through the dozens of pages, you see that yellow wasteland transform into a vivid paradise, the same one swaying in the breeze outside our window. That's the sound of a bell from the dock. Dayag's boat has returned with its catch. It's 9 a.m. just on time. We make our way down to the water. The skipper is Dayag's eldest son, Yoni.
How did it go?
Real good. Caught a bunch more off of old knots.
Yoni is a muscular image of his father. He has run his own skip for about 2 years. Along with his crew of a brother and a cousin, he fishes the deep waters. The boat comes alongside and the young men load out the crates of fish. Diag's youngest son, Amir, joins in for the sorting.
Tilapia.
Good.
Perch.
That's right.
I don't know.
That one in the water bucket, we haven't caught too many of those. I'll show you in the book.
You wouldn't know it, but Yoni's task is one of the most difficult. Most of the fishermen use large dragnets close to the shoreline. They're only allowed to fish with the large nets between a couple of the main towns on the coast to ensure the sea isn't overfished. Yoni's crew fishes further out, and there are no nets. Yoni fishes by hook and line.
It's laborious, but that's not a bad thing. You end up catching larger fish, which can be filleted. You don't have to worry about the bones. Plus, I really enjoy the catching of the fish rather than just pulling it in as you would with a net.
Back by the hut, Diag brings out a thick book, Fish of the Mediterranean Sea. It's a large, aged encyclopedia of all fish species that existed before the war. He points to a crimson-orange specimen with leopard-like, cobalt-colored spots.
It's getting more rare for us to spot new kind. We've cataloged such a huge variety already, but it still happens occasionally. You got to see one today. We add it to our list. Next time we haul one in, I expect my sons to know the kind, even Amir.
Coral grouper.
The Abners will clean the entire catch this morning. These early risers will finish the fishing part of their workday by lunchtime and dine on tilapia here at one of the waterfront parks. The Abners will supply about half the catch to their neighbors back in their village and a healthy portion to the neighborhood restaurant on Nob Hill. Amir will get an answer from Dad on whether he can add Jerry the Coral Grouper to his huge aquarium, which spans an entire wall of their estate house over the hill. Some of the catch will go onto families in Jerusalem, and Gilead will salt some to send to families beyond. A taste of fish from living waters in the sea that was once called dead. For KPCG in Jerusalem, I'm Brent Nuchtigal.
So, Brent, the Dead Sea had an extremely high salt content, right? I mean, that's what made it the Dead Sea. So what caused that, and then what led to the change?
Right, so the Dead Sea, as it was formerly known in the world that was, it didn't used to have an outlet. So all the water that came into it basically fed from the Jordan River, and then it would go into the lowest part of the earth, which is where the Dead Sea is, or the Salt Sea is today. And there it would be evaporated continuously over time so that the content, when water evaporates, salt doesn't go up into the heavens to be then form rainfall. The salt stays there. So over time, it kept on getting more and more saltier because of that access point from the Jordan. And I was talking to Avner, and he Mr. Avner, and he relayed the history here to just fill me in of why it lost its salt. Well, there was another tributary that was added to the Dead Sea soon after Jesus Christ returned. The Gihon Spring in Jerusalem just started to bubble up at just a more intense amount of water was given out, and that actually flowed westward towards the Mediterranean Sea, but it also followed eastward, and these healing waters of the Gihon Spring actually went into the Dead Sea, and over time, and the increase of rainfall as well, you had the rising of the water level that actually then made an exit point for the sea down into the Red Sea below it. The Red Sea is about 100 miles south of the Dead Sea. So there was a channel that was filled with water, and now you can actually access the southern Red Sea.
That's amazing. You talked about a couple of rules that they have, I guess, to prevent overfishing. How do they keep the stocks of the Salt Sea high?
Right. Well, they, starting out when they were fishing there, they actually had it easy because there was a pretty specific prophecy in the Bible that told them where they were allowed to fish in certain manners, how they could fish. Back in the world that was, there was a substantial part of the oceans were overfished, and that was because of incorrect techniques. They used massive nets catching anything that they could find in the ocean. But along the Dead Sea, they're only allowed to use nets, and they're along the coastal region on the western bank there, and they're only allowed to use the nets there so that a lot of fish, if they want to get the bigger fish that's further out in the sea, they have to use a hook and line. So obviously you can't overfish with a hook and line. It's still, you know, there's still a lot of fish. As I was saying, they had their record catch this year. So they are catching a lot of fish, but the rules are such that it would never be overfished. We also have to think about the fact that fish are no longer eating fish like they used to. So there is just a large amount of fish that can be caught.
Awesome stuff. This global overview is speculation of what the world will look like 100 years from now based on the prophecies of the Bible after Jesus Christ's return. If you're interested in more details, I want to encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com. There we offer a book written by Herbert W. Armstrong called The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It's a very inspiring book. It's filled with details based on biblical prophecies of that future world. Coming up, we have future headlines from Europe and America, and later on, our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world. But this week, we're not looking at events from this past week. We're projecting about events 100 years from now over the past week, based on biblical prophecy. We'll go now to Europe and our correspondent in Britain, Richard Palmer. Richard, can you give us an overview of important news coming out of Europe this week?
Yes, certainly. So this week, the Greeks sank piles into the sea off the Mediterranean, and the first leg of the international highway between Israel, Egypt, and Germany is on its way to completion down there in western Sinai. But in addition to that portion of the highway that crosses the land, the Greeks are contributing a staggering 127-mile bridge that will carry rail and coach traffic and ultimately will include off-ramps that stop at some of the most idyllic small islands in the Mediterranean. Also this week, veterinarians very carefully released aurochs back into the wild in northeast Poland. The auroch is a grand wild ox. It appeared to go extinct about 400 years before Christ's return. But the war actually exposed a few dozen of these animals in forest in Poland. A few pairs did survive. And so there's been a decades-long process of bringing these animals and their offspring back to full health. But the Poles got that finished this week. And then finally, good news for all of Europe's food lovers. Across Europe, weather conditions have been perfect. Good management along with the weather has led to record catches of cod for Europe's Atlantic fishermen, just like their fellow tradesmen in the Dead Sea that we heard about. Olive oil production is up yet again, and in France and Italy, both the professional and the many amateur vintners are excited about the potential quality of this year's grapes.
Well, that sounds like a win for food lovers around the world. So your top story from Europe this week.
Yes, my top story this week is about the scientific and technological advancements made by Germany over the last few decades. As we all know, German industry and science is a boon to the whole world. They have a reputation for producing machinery of the very highest quality. They're also on the cutting edge of technology, developing new equipment and then bringing it to production in a very reliable way. But today I'd like to delve a bit behind the scenes of the German industrial and scientific miracle. And so to do that, I traveled to Germany and looked at the real secret to Germany's success there, and that is its education. Today I'm examining the German industrial and scientific miracle, and so I'm sitting in a couch in the spacious living room of the Hans Zwiebel family. The Zwiebels live 18 miles from central Asher, out of sight of the giant Maritz coachworks. But what is happening there has everything to do with what is happening here.
Yes, well, the approach to education here in Germany is really the same as it is around the world. As a father, I'm primarily responsible for my child's education. And like any father, this is something I take very seriously.
Over tea with warm slices of Barnbrot, Hans Zwiebel tells me about teaching his children.
Most important is the spiritual education, training them how to behave, teaching them about the plan of God. But then I also begin the education about the physical world.
We're talking about engineering, and Hans emphasizes the connection between spiritual and physical education.
My wife and I teach them to obey their parents, so they listen well in outside classes. We dwell a long time on God and the Word and their decision to create, so they understand the origin of every physical creature, objects and substances. So when they create, whatever it is, they're doing it as a child of the Creator.
Hans and his wife Ada say that the physical always takes a back seat to the spiritual, but that understanding the spiritual deeply adds dimension and depth to the physical, which in turn emphasizes the spiritual.
I want my children to be the most useful members of this society that they can be, to equip them with skills they can use to serve others. Here this is, where the material education supports the spiritual. They develop character through the challenge that comes with learning new skills. It helps them develop into better people. It makes them better givers, and at the same time, gives them something they can give.
Children begin their education at home, but they also attend formal classes where they learn more specific ways how to live, including how to maximize their abilities to produce services, tools, and art that will benefit their families, their cities, their country, and the world.
I work with my boys and teach them on our farm. But twice a week, we go to the Asur for engineering statistics.
Along with 19 other neighboring children, Fritz and Melia's boys take the class. Their father is the one who teaches it.
The attitude of learning, the excellence behavior, the ability to open the mind, all of that is taught at home. I spend very little time dealing with undisciplined or distracted children, and most of them already have a sense of what a wind mile is, or basics of probability or soil strata, or the concept of inheritance. If they don't, they're excited to learn.
Families here have been learning and deepening this education form for 4 generations, but education in Germany was not always this way.
Before the war, Germany was also a leader in engineering and in education, but there is such a thing as wrong education. We questioned everything. We dove deep into psychology. We wrote the world, but we were wrong. It takes quite a long time to unlearn error. For my father and his father to unlearn the error. For me to keep it from creeping in. By this point, we have a strong foundation, a strong history of going back and back again to the Bible. The mind of the one who created all things, including the human mind itself.
Asher schools are obviously known for producing skilled engineers that travel the world to help other cultures, but these are not engineering schools, are they?
That is correct. Our aim is a balanced education. To educate the whole man, we make it clear to all our students that the Bible class are the most important. We come in once a week for an absolute incredible guest lecture program. God's members of the royal family from throughout history talk about Assyrian history, biology, minerals, leadership, everything. They make a big effort to have one-on-one conversations with as many students as possible, and that really fires them up and inspires our students. Our students take classes in all sorts of disciplines. Many of our best engineers are also very fine musicians, and everyone is also an athlete, of course. So many important lessons they learn on the ball field. It's all about living as the Creator designed us to live.
German tools and machinery are changing the world. They're making things happen that otherwise would not. What's the source? Highly paid engineers shut in a lab and devoting lifetimes to metallurgical failure analysis? No. The source is a balanced, godly education. A process that starts in the living room. For KPCG, I'm Richard Palmer in Osnabrück, Germany.
Well, thanks for that report, Richard. During your visit there, what was your sense of the contrast between education the way that it is now in the early millennium versus the way that it was that late modern German education before Jesus Christ returned?
Well, this is certainly not the first time that Germany has excelled at education or even led the world in education. So in the world that was before the tribulation, Germany really pioneered a style of questioning the world that attacked religious belief. Now, we know that in a lot of those religious beliefs during the world that was were completely wacky. And there are a lot that claim to be based on the Bible that were nothing of the sort. And so a lot of these intellectuals saw right through that And then they used that to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And Germany led the way in saying, we cannot trust divine revelation. We can't trust anything that claims to come from the supernatural. Education must be 100% centered in the physical, the provable. And they took that beyond just this thinking when it comes to the sciences, but even into philosophy, into questions of ethics and morality, and tried to get that grounded in what humans could reason and in the physical. And so we see they produced a lot of very disruptive scholars because of that. You know, Karl Marx, you had Nietzsche.
Well, I'm just trying to think, what a disaster to try to come up with your standards of morality without the spiritual dimension.
Exactly. And it's and we all vividly saw in the cataclysm of 100 or so years ago where that led.
Yeah. So the education that they're doing right now, what are some of the upshots that you see of the quality of German education that you really see blossoming in Germany today?
Well, what really fascinates me about this story is just how the whole world benefits from the actions of Germany's parents and teachers. And what was once upon a time back in those old days of education was looked at as a kind of a minor or unimportant role, like bringing up children and being a mother, has global implications. So, for example, one German research group recently unveiled a brand new terraformer. It's a fully automated solar-powered machine. It uses variations in Earth's magnetic field to calculate its position on the Earth's surface and above where it is altitude-wise, and it can do that to within half a cubit. And its speed is incredible. It can dig a mile-long irrigation channel in just a day. A fleet of these machines can completely change an entire landscape within months, and it's going to dramatically speed up the transformation of the last few inhospitable regions on Earth, lowering mountains, redirecting rivers, opening up valleys. It has a huge number of applications, and just about every major family on Earth is going to benefit from this machine. But as we saw in this segment, that traces back to the education in Germany, that traces back to the devotion of teachers and the devotion of parents and families within Germany. And it shows how this education benefits the entire world, even in just a material sense.
Yeah, and it also just shows how important it is to direct that education and to direct those skills, because you put that knowledge, you know, at one time it would have actually been channeled into making killing machines, right? Or pieces of equipment that were just frivolous and that rob people of their productive time. But, you know, when you educate people in the right way, or you direct that education in the right way, it really produces some wonderful results. Well, thank you for that report, Richard. That's very exciting stuff. We're going to go now to Anglo-America, and for that, we'll turn to Robert Morley. We'll start with the overview, Robert.
Well, I'd like to lead with what seems like a bit of a non-story. No one covered this because it's so commonplace today, but tucked into Wednesday's State of the Union was the fact that America's government reported that it had zero debt.
Yeah, and this is news.
I know. It is news, though. There's no debt. The budget is balanced. The sky is blue. These things are all self-evident, I know. But here we are into a century into the new world, and we have to take these opportunities to be grateful for what we have. So yes, yet again this year, we have zero debt, a healthy surplus. But it is interesting to take note of it, because on this day 100 years ago, the total unfunded liabilities of the United States passed $110 trillion. So in today's gold currency, that would be about $19 trillion. Every single taxpayer in America, given its population, would have had to pay more than $8,000 per year in order to have it paid off by this week.
And on top of that, they would have had the debt would have had to remain at that level.
Yeah, they would have had to stop borrowing, which they never did.
So any other news out of Anglo-America?
Well, yeah, there's some good news for estate owners and their families out there.
Which is everyone, in other words.
Right. If you're like me and your soil is finally rehabilitated, this year's National Arbor Week is especially exciting. It starts on Sunday, and the nurseries and plantations have been prepping for this all year. They're bringing out lots of volunteers. My daughter's a volunteer to help you select your plants and trees for your grounds. Fantastic advice available from landscape artists, completely free, of course. And yeah, go out there, buy yourself a fig tree or grapevine, and add it to your HMR entrance.
So, Robert, what's the big story from Anglo-America this week?
Yes, big news this week. It's about Melissa from Cana, Manasseh, 43 years old. She's the last remaining American suffering from cancer. And in her case, it traces back to the fallout that her great-grandmother suffered after the war. And this week, Melissa was healed. It was a tough battle for her, just physically and emotionally, and of course spiritually. But nutrition, exercise, and just years of spiritual growth and faith in God's healing, and she's now free, absolutely free of cancer. And this means even bigger news. The health department in Jerusalem says that it now has no record of cancer anywhere, and they're submitting that to members of the royal family to hopefully get a verification on that. But yeah, it looks like the global occurrence rate for cancer is now zero. So big news. And I took the occasion to travel to New London on Sunday to learn more about the plunging occurrence of cancer. Today I'm visiting the home office of the health department in Manasseh, just off the outdoor sculpture museum on Pergamus Street. Through a pair of mahogany doors, health department manager David Eddy is waiting. In his skylit study room, he shows me an antique log of something called a hospital.
Yes, they used to have so many people sick, not just with cancer. Injuries and chronic sicknesses of the lungs, heart, brain, lymph, skin, eyes, bone, just about everything, really. And they would take all the worst cases and put them in one building and try to treat them.
Looking back at the history books, cancer alone afflicted unbelievable numbers of people. And every year, the number of victims who died from cancer was in the millions.
From this completely preventable disease. Take colon cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, even thyroid cancer and kidney cancer. And there was even lung cancer, leukemia, and lymphoma.
These names were some of the most feared words a person could hear. And not just because of the disease itself.
Oh, and the treatments were barbaric. The doctors were trying to help, of course. But when you think a body evolved, and that with enough serums and lasers and knives you can heal someone, well, you end up with this.
Dr. Eddy shows me a couple of pages with photos of cancer patients being subjected to something called chemical therapy. They called it chemo. A couple pages is enough.
It wasn't just the doctors. There was this huge industrial establishment for caring for and trying to treat cancer victims and victims of other diseases and injuries and malformations. They all spent thousands of hours and also huge amounts of resources to finding cures. If only we could polymerize some serum and stick it in this person with a needle, we could heal them of cancer. At least that was the thinking.
The approach seems primitive.
Obviously it was backward, but they couldn't see that because health had always been that way. Do what you want, then try to cover up the effects later. It's kind of fascinating. They knew some laws were at play that make a chemical that corresponded to one or two of those laws that would lower your blood pressure, let's say, and it would break all these other laws. They would advertise these chemicals, and it was a profit-making thing, and they'd say at the end really fast, side effects may include headaches, nausea, urinary tract infection, all sorts of things like that.
The disclaimer about a chemical that people supposed was helping their hearts is all the more morbid because it contrasts so strongly to what I see around me here at the health home office. Open windows, tall oak trees, wide green lawns, flower beds buzzing with insects, and dozens of vigorously healthy-looking people.
We take it for granted as obvious, but what we are doing contrasts completely to those days. I'd say pretty much every last treatment was, in some ways, experimental. And every last treatment broke more health laws. We spend our time deepening our understanding of the health laws that have been in effect since Adam. And the other half of our time is spent educating. This is how we help people before they get sick. And all the fundamental principles are there in the Bible. Recognize the cause before it even happens. And that's why we're in such heavy communication with manufacturing and technology. They want to know if, you know, does smelting anodized tantalum with such and such a process potentially create carcinogens? Here's our research.
The health revolution has not been easy. It has taken time, Yet with each generation, life expectancies and standards of well-being are increasing. Economist Paul Strugman writes for the New Daily Times. He works at the high levels of the royal family, Joseph himself, to be precise. Strugman has recently highlighted the economic benefits of the ongoing health revolution.
People are spending 25 to 29% of their waking hours dealing with some of these cancerous diseases. They were losing 20% of their income to hospital visits, drugs, insurance. You take it for granted that almost everyone is in full health, just pouring himself into his family and his work. But that was not the case just 100 years ago.
Strugman has a name for this freedom from the time costs and financial costs of cancer and other diseases.
It's the health dividend. It's one of the biggest underlying reasons why you are even raising your family so well, why you are building a booming business, why your life is so full. When you factor in the power of compounding, it's one of the financial wonders of the world.
You don't have to look far for evidence of Strugman's health dividend. As I walk out of his office back onto the Garden Line Street, I'm actually in an area that was once known as Skid Row a century ago. With mental disorders largely a thing of the past, with alcoholism and drug abuse almost eliminated, with divorce almost non-existent, happy, healthy families produce happy, productive, well-balanced members of society.
What do you mean, begging for money? What does that mean? Why didn't they have their own money?
Mom, what's a soup kitchen? Can we go to the park and ride some lions?
Dr. Eddy relates the single biggest factor behind the healthcare and resulting economic revolution.
It all comes down to family. Once the families were fixed, a lot of the problems that used to be commonplace took care of themselves. Once people were educated about how to live happy, productive, healthful lives, it did wonders.
There's more work ahead for Dr. Eddy and his colleagues at the royal family. Cancer may well be gone, but there's a lifetime ahead of learning, educating, obeying, and healing. For KPCG, I'm Robert Morley in New London.
What a meaningful look at something that really even the elderly among us take for granted. Almost everyone we know has awesome health.
Yes, that's just the starting point, right? I mean, we're all healthy, but there's a huge body of work that we're benefiting from. A huge amount of study and prayer and education, learning the knowledge, vetting it, diving into the Bible, counseling with members of the royal family, and then spreading that knowledge, that right knowledge.
Well, thanks for that report, Robert. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to check out Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It'll give you a more complete overview of what the Bible says about the state of the world 100 years from now and beyond, based on the Bible's prophecies of what happens after Jesus Christ's return, which is coming very soon. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from the future from all our panelists. Coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week, 100 years into the future, that caught our attention. We'll start with Brent.
Jerusalem is reporting that the world growth rate is soaring. People are having babies, families are growing. It's wonderful. This soaring growth rate isn't a bad thing because obviously we need to populate the whole surface of the world. Corresponding with this is now there is actually 32% of the land on Earth is actually cultivatable. There was only 15% back 100 years ago that you have land that you're able to grow things, but now that's increased to 32%. So the carrying capacity of the Earth, we're just going to have to revise. They're looking over the stats again, and they think that the Earth can handle a whole lot more people.
Excellent. We'll move on now to Richard.
Registration is open for next month's big cat races in Padavatar, India. That's a major recreational event in northern India, and it's a great chance to visit a great nation at its most festive. So if you go there, you can spend a week in Padavatar next month, and some people go there without even seeing a race. There's just so much to do in those foothills. So you've got the family meals, of course, and you've got Indians coming from all over the world setting up those big tents that Palo Atabar is so famous for and welcoming the visitors in there. There's nothing quite like a good, spicy Palo Atabar curry. But then you've also got things like the strength contest, the sky rides, the storytelling, the nature walks, the huge falconry shows, and so on and so on. But this event, of course, all started with the big cats. So if you do have a youngster, 60 pounds or lighter, who wants to enter his or her steed, contact Palo Atabar City Hall. And your child can ride his or her cat in the sprints, the long distance, the agility competitions. And of course, it is open to lions, to jaguars, leopards, cougars, cheetahs, and the crowd favorite, Bengal tigers.
All right. Thank you, Richard. We'll go on now to Jeremiah.
Just something to note here as the harvests come in. The Luzon Regional Government in the Philippines has asked for donations for 17 new printing facilities that it needs to build in locations across the Philippine Islands. These facilities will produce Bibles and Bible textbooks. At present, the rate of production is still too low to meet the demand, the need, really. In many cases, entire extended families are still having to share just one copy of the Bible, and even more families lack the new Bible textbooks on biology, history, and so forth. So, of course, this leads to some fantastic family interactions, family Bible studies just knitting those strong Philippine families together even more. But obviously, there is a real need to increase the number of Bibles and Bible textbooks in such a populous region. So the government is asking for donations. The Philippines are ready to accept press components, fine and semi-fine paper, ink, leathers and leather goods, linen or long staple cotton thread, looms, and of course, any surplus finished copies of the Bible and Bible textbooks that you might have. So just contact the Luzon City Hall to make donations.
Okay, and on to Robert.
The international highway from Jerusalem to Cairo continues its construction and at a really rapid pace. This week, workers finished the Nineveh Junction and sunk the first piles into the Mediterranean for the long journey towards Germany. Lots of visitation and commerce between Israel and Egypt, of course. Large amount of coach traffic there at Mount Sinai itself. Getting to Cairo still takes several hours, but the recycling crews have cleared most of the rubble and new bridges are going up. The foreman for the Egyptian construction crew is Uday Dese. He says Cairo should be linked up just before the Feast of Tabernacles next year. Then Job says from there it's on to Germany.
Fantastic. Well, I wanted to conclude by just recapping Abraham's broadcast from last Sabbath here. The royal family has been emphasizing long-term vision a lot over this past year. Here we're a century into the millennium, and Abraham spoke about the struggle, specifically the struggles of the old world, struggling against society and sin and self, struggling against the elements, the environment, struggling against other men, struggling even for survival. Well, obviously, we still struggle against sin, but so many of the things of the world that was, the struggles of that age, they've been obliterated by Jesus Christ. But part of the struggle against sin, Abraham said, is to see the future. The struggle is to lock in onto New Jerusalem. And he really charged the crowds with an electrifying vision to struggle to become perfect, but not for its own reward, but looking ahead, doing it for the sake of the overall mission. There is a mission, the mission of the millennium, the mission that we all need to keep in sight is that even while we're living in a paradise, we have to think about the coming resurrection. We have to think about the billions of people who are going to be rising up at the end of this millennium and that we're going to have to help and to serve and to take care of and to educate. So a very inspiring vision there from Abraham. Well, I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to check out Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Send us your thoughts, your comments by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley. Gentlemen, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I want to thank Philip Nice, who helped us with the scripting, several other volunteers who helped out in a number of ways, and a special thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan, who did more than double duty to pull this project off. I'll leave you with the words of Herbert W. Armstrong from The Wonderful World Tomorrow. This is how the book concludes. It's talking about what's going to happen once Jesus Christ is King of Kings. All will know the truth. No more religious confusion. Humans will become teachable. People will start living God's way, the way of outgoing concern for others, the way of true values, the way of peace, of happiness, of well-being, of joy. Crime, sickness, disease, pain, and suffering, gone. Poverty, ignorance, banished. Smiles on people's faces, faces that radiate. Wild animals tame. Air pollution, water pollution, soil pollution, gone. Crystal pure water to drink. Clean, crisp, pure air to breathe. Rich black soil where deserts, mountains, and seas formerly were, producing full-flavored foods and fantastic beauty in flowers, shrubs, trees. A world filled with happy, radiating humans, guided, helped, protected, and ruled by former mortals made immortal, and all the humans realizing that they too may inherit everlasting life in supreme happiness and thrilling joy. What a fabulous picture. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It truly has been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.